Retro.
Go.
Fido.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance, go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the May 27th, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Well, thanks for climbing on board with us today on a Memorial Day weekend in which we have a tropical storm hovering nearby. So what better place to be on this dreary Sunday than next to your radio or computer listening in as we spend the next hour with a very special guest today, Apollo 15 Command Module pilot Al Warden. If you ever wanted to ask a question or talk with an Apollo astronaut who has circled the moon, well, then today is your chance to do so. Ask your questions, send us your comments about anything really having to do with our space program. They're all welcome. Please feel free to give us a call anytime during the program today or send us an email. Again, no question too dumb, no opinion not worthy of at least some discussion. Our phone number is 768-1240. The area code is 321 if you need it. And our email address is spacetalking@aol.com. Well, I've got a couple of topics to touch on this morning, so let's get right into today's edition of my weekly broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations. Something happened a week ago Thursday that I thought was pretty interesting. Lost in the noise of all the preparations to launch the SpaceX Falcon 9, I'm not sure anyone in the space community really noticed it, but on that one day, Thursday, May 17th, here's what happened. After launching from Kazakhstan late on Monday the 15th, on Thursday the 17th, at 12:36 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, the next Soyuz spacecraft carrying three crew members, including NASA astronaut Joe Acaba, docked with the International Space Station. Then, on that same Thursday, at 10:05 a.m. Eastern Time, another Soyuz rocket launched from the Plesetsk Cosmodrome in Russia with an imaging spy satellite. Then, at 12:39 p.m. Eastern Time, at the Tanegashima Space Center in southern Japan, an H-2A rocket launched into orbit, carrying an Earth observation satellite for South Korea, a Japanese climate observing satellite, a small technology demonstration satellite for the Japanese Space Agency, and an experimental student-built satellite. And then, at 3:12 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time that same Thursday, a Russian Proton rocket launched from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan with a Canadian communications satellite. All that. And on one day during that week, also saw an Ariane 5 rocket launched from the Guiana Space Center in South America with a pair of communication satellites for Japan and Vietnam. Now, all of those launches were successful. All of those satellites were safely deployed into orbit. I tell you this because it should be made very clear that the rest of the world is staying busy in space, and we better not lose sight of that. Yes, we in the United States are busy too. We had a great week, thanks to SpaceX and NASA. But we must absolutely not ignore the fact that we're not the only game in town, especially if we want to remain this planet's leader in the exploration and use of space. And we certainly did do that. Early Friday morning, as astronaut Don Pettit grabbed hold of the Dragon space capsule with the space station's robot arm, as that was happening, I sat at my desk staring at the picture-perfect image on my monitor, and a surge of emotions washed over me. It was an incredible moment when another private company had launched its own rocket and its own spacecraft into Earth orbit. It's been done before, but for the first time, they flew their own cargo ship to within a few feet of the International Space Station. accomplishing what only national governments, with all that that implies, had done before. When it was confirmed the Dragon was locked in place at the station's Harmony node, well, I'll admit it, that's when I actually felt the first hint of tears welling up inside me. This was a big deal, not only for our space program, but for the history of our nation. Now, unfortunately, not everyone thinks the same way that I do. Some say it's no big deal because all SpaceX did was something NASA first did during the Gemini program in 1965. I say you try to launch a spacecraft to a precise spot in low Earth orbit next to a space station with six human lives on board, with the whole world watching, and then tell me it was no big deal. Some say this wasn't a pure commercial private effort because taxpayer money helped pay for it. I say, so what if taxpayer money is involved? The way that NASA is contracting with SpaceX for these services is completely different than the usual way it's done. And that means that any way you slice this, as an average taxpayer, I'm getting more bang for my buck, and that's a big deal. Some say Elon Musk is a billionaire, so why doesn't he pay for all of this himself? Or that when SpaceX becomes profitable, it should pay back all the money NASA gives them with interest. Some say this week's success is a fluke and won't soon be repeated. Some say private industry will never be able to do what NASA can do now. Some point to this mission and credit the most recent President Bush for supporting the idea of commercial space as part of canceling the space shuttle program. Some point to this mission and credit President Obama for supporting the idea of commercial space as part of canceling the Constellation program. I guess once again we see that it's true that you can't please everyone. Look, if you strip out the complexities created by all the technical skepticism, hidden agendas, class warfare, disparaging rhetoric, and counterproductive politics that are tearing our nation apart, you get an awe-inspiring, made-only-in-America story that is easy to understand and profound in what it represents. Here's the story. A guy comes along and wants to build a rocket. He thinks space is cool and believes the rest of the world should see how cool space is, too. He is confident he knows a better way to do business in space than the way he's seen that others have been doing it for years. So he puts some money together, assembles a team, locates a place to work, designs the necessary hardware, tests it, fails, tries again, fails again, but keeps at it through difficult times until he and his team get it right. 10 years after it all began, they launch a rocket called Falcon 9 for the third time. On top of the rocket is a spacecraft called Dragon, which is making its second flight. The rocket is named after a fictional space cruiser piloted by a guy who apparently doesn't shoot first, and the cargo ship is named after a song about something that is impossible to believe could be real, but is. The launch is spectacular and makes news around the world. The ship safely arrives at the International Space Station, delivering its cargo of food, a new laptop computer, and a few as yet unidentified surprises for the six crew members on board. It's the first time a private company has done what only a national government has been able to do before. There is much rejoicing on the ground, champagne all around. But the story isn't finished. The ship still must safely return to Earth, and then another rocket and cargo ship must be prepared for a launch in just a couple of months and also have a successful mission, followed by another and another and another. At some point, there will be failures to overcome. New competitors will enter a market that is still in search of more customers and still must prove it can be profitable. There will be other challenges that can't be predicted. But all this is going to get done. It's a big job, and so far, Elon Musk and his SpaceX team are proving they're up to the task. So to a guy who's followed the space program all his life and understands the complexities involved, I appreciate how special this moment was early Friday when once again we witnessed space history being made. In fact, it wasn't only a big deal, it was a heck of a deal. And that's this week's Orbital Inclinations. When we return from our first break, Apollo 15 astronaut Al Warden will join us by phone. Please stay tuned. I'm Jim Behnke. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com.
If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMV.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. 321-768-1240 is the number to call to participate in the program today. Or you can also send us an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Well, one of the great things about living here in Florida on the Space Coast, being a part of the space community, is that you get to meet and get to know some truly remarkable people who spend their time helping turn dreams of space exploration into reality. My guest today did just that during Project Apollo, and he continues to contribute today as an author and active member of the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation, helping our future space leaders get a start in life. Al Warden was born and raised in Michigan, was a graduate of West Point, served as an Air Force test pilot, joined NASA in 1966 as part of the astronaut group nicknamed the Original 19. And after serving on support and backup teams for Apollo 9 and Apollo 12, Al flew as the command module pilot for Apollo 15, becoming one of only 24 humans who have ever circled the moon. All of this and much more is detailed in his book, Falling to Earth, an Apollo 15 Astronaut's Journey to the Moon. And he joins us today on the phone from his home state of Michigan. Al, how you doing today? Well, we're doing great now. It could be. Now, Sean, let me tell you something. I'm hearing Colonel Warden over the phone, but not through through the board. I'm not sure where the disconnect is. Al, if you would just stand by. Sean's going to run in here and check out and see what happens. Al was I can hear you great, but we can't hear you through the system. So where are we at? We're on here, we're on there. And Al, give us a count.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Okay, we're gonna call Al back here. All right, we'll stand by. Okay. We'll stand by here as we get Al back on the phone. Never happened before to us here. I'm sure it was Bill Mick that screwed this all up for us, and we'll talk to him. We're in the showcase studio at WMMB, and we're standing by to talk to Colonel Al Warden. Apollo 15 command module pilot. Al has, Apollo 15 was a great mission, a great science mission. We're going to talk to him about it, of course, in detail. Some of the things that happened during this flight were absolutely incredible. This was the first lunar landing. Now, of course, Al stayed in the command module. So while he was in lunar orbit, his colleagues, Dave Scott and Jim Irwin, went down in the lunar module called Falcon. Falcon lands on the lunar surface. It's the first Apollo mission that has the lunar rover in it. And great amount of science done, a lot of geology. And I don't know if you call it geology or lunarology. You'll have to ask that question, too. Meanwhile, while all that's going down on the ground and they're doing the lunar rover, and, okay, now we're going to try this again here. Stand by. Yep. And, Al, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, I can hear you. I can hear you great.
All right.
Well, Al, we were telling everybody about Apollo 15 and some of the things that happened, but let's back it up a little bit. First of all, you're up in Michigan, where you're born and raised. I remember that your family farm had been sold, but do you still have farmland up there? Or
no, don't. No. In fact, I'm about 90 miles away from where I was born and raised. We are now in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is over on the West Coast.
Sure. Sure. And just like a summer home kind of a deal?
Well, yeah, we've got a nice little cottage on a golf course here, and it's quite nice. As a matter of fact, the temperature right now is 77 degrees, and it's sunny skies and beautiful.
Well, let's see. It's 78 degrees here, but we have a tropical storm over us right now.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Okay.
Just a little bit. Turn our squall lines right now over the Kennedy Space Center. So.
Oh, okay. Well, you're going to get wet. And the nice thing about Michigan is you never know. It could rain in an hour from now up here.
Yeah, that's
you never know.
You never know
what's going to happen. Right.
You know, born and raised in Michigan on the farm, my family hails from southern Minnesota and farm country. Mm-hmm. And reading your book, you know, so many scenes and stories that you told. I could see my grandpa doing the same thing. I could see family members doing the same thing. And there was a lot made back then, Alan, during the Apollo.
Are you saying that I'm like your grandpa?
Well, I'm not. I'm saying, you know, that you're probably about the same age as my father. Let's put it that way.
Oh, okay. That's getting a little more real. See, Jim, I know you, Jim.
Yeah, I know you do. Well, you know, it's kind of funny. We hit the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy Space Center this year, and I'd like to think they're celebrating with my birthday, too, because, you know, I just also turned 50. So.
Yeah, right. Anyway, well, congratulations.
Well, thanks. But anyway, so there was a lot made about astronauts that flew in Apollo, flew Mercury and Gemini, that a lot of them had come from the farm, a rural background. And there was something said about or suggested about the work ethic and about the kind of personality it takes to do what you guys did as test pilots and astronauts in those
days.
Well,
I think it's a combination of a lot of things. Back in the day, the guys who grew up in the Midwest basically looked outward and tried to find something that would get them away from where they started, like I did in Jackson.
Yeah.
One of my goals when I was a young man was that I was going to get away from Jackson and never come back. There are lots of other things to do out there, lots of other places to be. I don't know whether that had anything to do with it or not, but if you look at the characteristics of those who went into the program early on in the program, you find that most of them are first sons or second son if the oldest child was a daughter.
Yeah.
They're from the Midwest. They're mostly Protestant. There are some Catholics, but mostly Protestant. They had sort of similar backgrounds. They all went to college basically on their own. They either went to a military academy or they went to a college on their own. They were self-motivated people, and that got them into flying, and that got them along. You know, once they got into flying, they decided, many of them, that just flying wasn't enough. They had to do something more than that. And I think that all comes from kind of a farm background where you grow up as, I won't say in isolation, but farms are not close to other people, so you learn to fend for yourself. You learn a lot of responsibility because you got to take care of those animals. They can't take care of themselves.
Yeah.
So you learn some values very young in life put you in good stead for the rest of your life.
In your work with the Astronaut Scholarship Foundation, you get exposure to a lot of students and helping them out with scholarships. Do you see some of that same kind of work ethic in these kids today? Is the future in good hands?
I hope there are enough of them to make a difference. We provide scholarships for probably 0.1% of the students that could really make a difference in the country.
Yeah.
So whether that small group can really make a difference or not, but the group that has gone through the program has done very, very well, and they've really proven themselves to be excellent at what they do. Not very many of them follow the path of flying and that sort of thing. They mostly become engineers, scientists, doctors, getting PhDs, medical MDs, that kind of thing. And they're outstanding kids, and we need them all over the spectrum in the country. So it's not that we've been trying to promote those who could go into the space program. We're trying, the foundation tries to promote anybody who's really, really smart. Yeah. In science or engineering.
Yeah, that's great. You know, your book covers so many details. There's so many things we could jump off here. But the one line that I actually chuckled over when I read through the book was, at one point you described playing one of your music cassette players. You spun the cassette player, and it spun in some weird directions. And you said, space is weird. And it was a great line. Talk about, your memories. What really stands out the most to you after all these years about your flight and why space was so weird to you?
Well, space, all of your preconceived ideas about Newton's law, as an example, kind of go out the window. When you're inside a big can and you're floating out there in free fall, and you and the can are in free fall, and you, with respect to the can, are what we'll call zero gravity, which... obviously there's no such thing as zero gravity, but it seems like that's the way we describe it. And you can do things inside the spacecraft that's impossible to do here on Earth. As an example, We took the center couch out one day. We got Jim Irwin to roll up with a ball, and we started him spinning. And we said, stick out an arm. And sure enough, he slowed right down, you know, just like ice skaters do.
Sure.
And then he'd pull his arm in, and he'd speed up, and he'd put it out, and he'd slow down. And, you know, we had to stop him after a while because we were a little concerned that he might drift off into an instrument panel. But it was kind of an interesting experiment. And the cassette player that I had, if you started it spinning, it would go around about twice, and then it would flip 90 degrees to a new axis.
Yeah.
Go three times, flip to a new axis, and it kept doing that over and over and over. And that would only happen in free fall or in what I'll call zero gravity or microgravity.
Yeah,
whatever.
Microgravity, sure.
But some very strange things happen up there when you get outside or when you counterbalance the force of gravity. Things act very differently than you're used to.
Yeah, that's incredible. Hey, Al, please stand by. We lost a couple of minutes here, but we're already up on our
sure.
first break. So stand right. by for a moment, and we'll come back to you in just a little bit. We're going to stop now, take our five-minute built-in hold at the bottom of the hour, get you caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports. We come back more with Apollo 15 astronaut Al Warden. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. Call Jim now, 768-1240.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk here on WMMB. Our phone lines again and online inbox open for your questions and comments. The phone number 321-768-1240. The email address is spacetalking@aol.com. And on this Memorial Day weekend, do want to take a quick moment, give a shout-out to all of those serving in the military, and thank you for your service, and to remember those who have given their lives so that we can do things like explore space. In fact, NASA Administrator Charlie Brolden sent a note out to all the NASA folks this week asking everyone to remember Memorial Day and noted that every manned space mission flown from the United States has had a veteran on board in one way or the other. Colonel Al Warden from the United States Air Force, Apollo 15 astronaut. You served in the Air Force as well. You graduated from West Point. How important was that military service to your life? I know it certainly prepared you to fly as an astronaut, but how has that served you well through the years?
Well, it's hard to say. I learned a lot of things at West Point. I would guess one of the things I learned was that before I went to West Point, I was a bit of a slob living on a farm. When I got to West Point, they straightened me out, and I've been fairly neat and clean since then.
You've got some great stories in your book.
I think West Point instills a dedication in people that is hard to get somewhere else. You know, the motto there is to lead, you have to learn how to follow.
Right.
And part of the training there, the first couple of years, is you follow orders. And you follow them precisely, and you do exactly as you're told. And if you do, you don't get in trouble. If you don't follow the orders, you get in trouble with the upperclassmen.
Right.
So it's a kind of what do I want to say? It's kind of a decision you make. That you're going to follow the orders that you have, and that hopefully will prepare you. You see, the big thing about West Point is duty, honor, country. The honor part of that is that you always try and tell the truth. If you're on the battlefield and you're on a landline back to headquarters and you tell them something that's not true, you might get your whole platoon or company or battalion wiped out.
Yeah.
So you got to be honest on the battlefield to let the people upstairs know exactly what's going on. That's one of the things you learn at West Point, is to be honest about things.
Well,
duty, that's dedication. I mean, that just means if you got a goal set, boy, you work hard and you go after that goal. That's the dedication part of it. And you know, part of the motto at West Point is country.
Yeah.
We're all very patriotic. That all of those who come out of West Point do anything for the country.
Well, yeah, and again, going through the book, there's so much to talk about. We're going to talk about kind of why you named it Falling to Earth here in just a moment. But, you know, there were a couple – by the way, Al, first of all, it's a great book.
Thank you.
I've always thought that Mike Collins' Carrying the Fire was kind of the standard by which I judge all other books by astronauts. And a lot of them rehash a lot of stuff, and they all kind of sound the same. You've got that fresh perspective on things, and I truly mean this. I'm quite sincere. I'm not trying to say it so you don't hang up on me. It was a great book. Learned a lot. Learned some things I didn't know before. For example, this is the stupidest thing of all, but I'm a space cadet. I did not know in my whole life, in staring at your Apollo 15 patch, and I'll never forget, I think it was NBC's coverage, had this great animation of the three kind of eagle things, birds flying together, that you had snuck the Roman numeral X and V, the 15, into the craters on the patch.
That was one of the things we did. Of course, we were told not to do that, but we thought all the patches before ours had Roman numerals on them.
Yeah.
And we just didn't think that was right, so we rearranged the craters behind the landing site. Kind of the shadows look like an X and a V.
And when I finally looked at it, I couldn't wait to go. And when I read that in the book, I had to go whipping in my office because there wasn't a good picture of it in the book. I saw that 15 sitting there, and I can't believe I'm as old as I am, and I've never seen that. The other thing I got a kick out of that was on kind of the amusing note was, and I know you had a lot of great respect for Dave Scott as your commander, and you're very clear about that in your book.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All the things that happened to you as a rookie on the flight that were kind of interesting, and Dave would look at you and say, oh, I forgot to tell you about that. You know,
what happened, of course, Dave had been in flight before. He'd been on Apollo 9, and he was on Gemini 8. So he knew all the little things that were going to happen to us when we left Earth. And some of those things he kind of forgot to tell us, like what was going to happen when the first stage separated.
Yeah.
That was kind of interesting because Jim and I were elbows and hands and everything in front of us trying to stay away from the instrument panel when the first stage shut down. We weren't expecting that. And Dave's comment was, gee, guys, I forgot to tell you about that. And the first night trying to go to sleep, it was a real experience because you no longer have gravity holding your head down, so it tends to kind of wander around on you. We woke up the next morning with real backaches, and Dave said, oh, gee, guys, I forgot to tell you about that. That's going to happen.
You know, all the training you do.
Non-consequential kinds of things, you know, nothing that affected the flight itself, but just little things. And the big part of going into space is learning how to live there. And so these were things that were important, but didn't affect the overall effect or the success of the flight itself.
And you just think with all the training and all the time you spend together that those things would be kind of come up in conversation, but you're so focused on the checklist and what the trainers are telling you.
Right. There are a lot of things we didn't get into. As an example, we ate all of the food that we're going to eat on the flight. We ate all that before the flight just to check it out, you know, to make sure that it was okay.
Sure.
There were certain things we did not do before the flight. And you know, it's just something that you got to put in your mind and say, well, this is what I'm going to do when I get in flight, like going to the bathroom.
Right.
That was very different in flight than anything that we're used to down here on Earth because you don't have that gravity pulling it down. So there were some things like that were interesting, didn't affect the flight, but, we decided that, there were things that we would live through, and we'd be fine, and we were.
There are a lot of things about your flight that the history books are very clear on, and they've been kind of rehashed and over again. I want to ask you a couple of things. First of all, the HBO series From the Earth to the Moon, a lot of people are familiar with Apollo 15 basically only because of the one episode. It was a great episode of the series. Tell us about the king. Tell us about Farouk. Your Farouk, yeah.
Farouk is one of the most interesting, wonderful people that I've ever met in my life. He is a great, great guy.
He taught you about
the moon. Very, very good geology instructor. Very excited about what we were doing. Very positive, very up, very happy with everything. And Farouk and I we correspond even today.
Really?
He's still a very close friend. Farouk, as you know, is Egyptian. He left Egypt on his own and came to this country. I don't know whether he got diplomatic immunity or whether he just came into the country because he was married to an American girl. how that all came about, but I know he left Egypt because of several things, like Egypt wouldn't recognize his marriage to Pat, and that really upset him. And then they put him in the army and sent him out to the Sinai to be an instructor for the troops. And Pat was left in Cairo, and she didn't, they wouldn't recognize her, so she ended up going back to Boston. And Fruit made up his mind that he was going back to Boston too, so he did. He got an engagement to give a talk at Heidelberg University on petroleum geology, and he just kept on going and went to Boston. And he ended up working for Bell Labs, training us in geology, which was probably the best thing that ever happened to me.
Tell me about a couple of things with some quick answers here. Tell us about your experience with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Well, I had called about a month before the flight, I called Sesame Street to ask them if they would do a show around the launch, because at that time, children under 16 were not allowed on the Cape. They hemmed and hawed, and a week later they said, well, we'll do it, but only if you'll name the command module Big Bird. And after I gave them the Big Bird, I called Fred Rogers. And in a one-hour phone call with Fred up in Pittsburgh, we had the whole thing resolved, and he got the NOVA crew from Boston to come down, and we did. We shot video all weekend down at the Cape before I went into quarantine, and then he did a special, which was shown just before the flight. And then I ended up going back and doing 7 or 8 more shows with him up in Pittsburgh, yeah. And he's a wonderful man. And his philosophy about how to teach kids was absolutely dead on, absolutely perfect. He just taught kids values, which is something that the other children's shows didn't do. The other children's shows taught kids how to add and subtract and that kind of thing, but they didn't teach values, and he did. And I got very close to Fred. He was a really good friend for a long, long time until he died.
That's incredible. Dee O'Hara, you're a nurse, and you're still close with her, I understand.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Dee is a very sweet person. She was a lieutenant nurse at Patrick, and she moved over to NASA early in the program before I got there, and she was the nurse to all the Mercury guys and all the guys afterwards up through Apollo and even not into the shuttle program. She came out to Ames back in 73, I think. I was already there. In fact, I kind of talked her into coming out there, and because she was getting kind of discouraged at Houston with what was going on. So she came out to Ames, and she finished up her career out there, and she still lives out there.
Oh, that's great. Hey, Al, a Facebook fan of the Space Talk show wanted me to ask you, what's the dumbest question someone has asked about the moon or spaceflight in general? With about 30 seconds to go here.
Did you see any aliens out there? The answer is absolutely no. Did you see any UFOs? Absolutely not. Do you think there are UFOs out there? Absolutely not. Do you think there's life out in the universe? Absolutely yes.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, okay, Al, stand by. We're going to take our final break of the day. When we come back, we're going to wrap up our discussions for the week, talk some more about Al Warden's book, and we'll also take a look at the local launch forecast, maybe even get Colonel Warden's opinion on the SpaceX launch and Dragon
okay.
mission, okay? We'll stand by for that. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Banky.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk. With a quick reminder, you can stay in touch with us throughout the week. If you're on Facebook, just search for the Space Talk page. If you're on Twitter, our handle is Space Talking. And for one-stop shopping, just visit WMMBAM.com, keywords Space Talk. And now as we continue, let's take a moment for our weekly look at the local launch forecast. The next launch from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, now targeted for June 18th. A United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket is to fly from Complex 41 with a secret satellite for the National Reconnaissance Office. We won't know the launch time until we get much closer to the date, so there's not much more to tell you right now. We'll keep you up to date. Also in June, by the way, we hope to see a Delta IV Heavy launch from the Cape on the 28th of June. It's also on a secret satellite mission for the NRO. And as I've said before about this rocket, it is a monster. It still scares me half to death when it lifts off, and it's definitely going to put on a good show. Again, for more information about all the various launches scheduled around the world, jump on the web to WMMBAM.com, keyword space talk, and look for the link to our launch forecast. Command module pilot for Apollo 15, Colonel Al Warden, is with us today, phoning in from Michigan, where it's apparently a lot nicer there than it is here with the tropical storm Beryl hovering over us. And Al, you know, if I had my way, we could talk about Apollo 15 for hours and not mention about what happened after the flight. But you entitled your book Falling to Earth, and you address it right up front, the whole issue that led to your, I guess, departure from NASA. I don't want to rehash all the details of the story, but suffice it to say, there was some issues. You got hauled out of Houston, and after all these years, you know, what do you have to say about it? What should we learn from it? What should we know about it?
Well, I should have followed my own instincts back in the day. Jim Irwin and I were making our first flight. We relied on our commander explicitly. Anything he wanted to do was okay because he'd been there before, and he knew the ropes, and he knew what was good and what was bad. So we got talked into carrying postal covers on the flight for a German stamp dealer. And I will say this, the German stamp dealer is completely innocent of anything. He didn't do anything. He just made a very open offer to another German fellow who worked at the Cape at the time. That he took his offer to Dave. Dave got Jim and I together. We talked about it, and we agreed to do it. It was not the right thing to do, and in a, you know, hindsight's wonderful. But we were told, and I certainly understand since then, that just about every flight before ours had done the same thing.
Sure.
We were the ones that they made an example of. And at the time, I think there was some management stress at NASA, or at Houston anyway, where the director was trying to downplay the importance of the astronaut office. And yeah. I think it was just a golden opportunity for him to make that point by getting rid of us. The only problem that I had with all of that was that he didn't get rid of Dave Scott, too.
Right, right. Dave went on to do some other things for NASA and moved on up. You know, and I, you know, I'm like we said earlier, I'm 50, I'm a grown adult, I should understand all these things, but I still have too much Minnesota nice in me.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe some naivete, which, of course, you mentioned in your book as well. It just bothers me. The more I learn about, well, let's just say Chris Kraft, the more it bothers me about, you know, how this program was managed, especially as our country evolved from the 60s into the 70s and the beginning of political correctness and the beginning
mm-hmm.
of all sorts of things that you just, you know, you just let the guys do what they did back then. And some of that swashbuckling, good old boy, right stuff is, you know, was going out the window, and you were made an example, and unfairly, I would add.
Well, I think that's about what happened. The only sad part of it, and the thing that still kind of grates me, is the fact that the guy who put the whole thing together was the guy who stayed in Houston.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand it then, and I don't understand it now.
Yeah.
I respect Dave for his professional competence. He was probably the greatest commander that a person could have. But outside of that, it was a whole different story.
Yeah. Now, looking forward, a lot of great things happening in our program. We talked about SpaceX and Dragon. I had another Facebook question, basically along the lines of, you know, based on your experience as a command service module pilot, what was an operational aspect, perhaps of ergonomics, visibility, or whatever in the cockpit that you would change? And related to that, what would you recommend, you know, the future guys for designing, you know, these next-generation capsules that are going to take our people into space, like Dragon, like SpaceX, and this whole new way of doing business?
Well, it is a whole new way, and it's becoming more and more a civilian program. And I think what they're doing is fine to go to the space station and stay in Earth orbit. They can't go beyond that.
Yeah.
I think only the national government has the funds, the resources, and the talent to do something really dramatic, like sending a crew to Mars. So The corporate people are not going to get involved in that because there's no profit in it, at least quick profit.
Yeah, yeah,
no,
yeah.
You know, they're looking at the bottom line for this year and next year, and the federal government can look at the bottom line 15, 20 years from now. And that's why it's important that the federal government stay in the business and do the long-range stuff. I have no problems with whoever is going to take people to the space station. I think I'm a little concerned that they're cutting corners to keep the cost down so they can make a profit, but I think it's going to be okay. I don't have a problem with that. I just think the federal government has opted out of any direct involvement with what's going on. I think that's a shame.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. Well, Al, with about a minute left here to go, I want to wrap up with your thoughts on being at the moon. You're out at the moon. You're looking back. You know, Jim Irwin had some profound experiences and religious, went into ministry, which I think was great. You talk about your reaction and your feelings. And at one point you said that you're looking back at Earth and you were changed in a way that it'll never go away. All these years later, tell us really quickly, you know, what was that?
Well, I think when you look back at the Earth from that far away, you realize that the Earth is a finite body of mass stuck in the universe floating around the sun. And looking the other way, you see a universe that is almost immeasurable, innumerable stars and planets, stars and suns and planetary systems. And you realize intuitively that we're pretty neophytes in this whole business. There are probably intelligent beings out there that are a million years advanced on us, and they can do anything they want. And so I think that looking back at Earth, you realize that we're like anything else that's alive. We're looking for survival of the species, and our survival is to go to another planet somewhere that will sustain life, much the same as anything that's organic or that grows here on Earth does the same thing. Everything is imperative is to survive the species.
And Al, we're going to have to leave it.
And I think humans are the same way.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Al, thank you so much for taking time. We're going to see you hopefully back here in September, okay?
Good to talk to you.
Talk
we'll see
you again.
You, see you later in the year.
Take care. Okay, and there goes Al Warden. Hey, next week on Space Talk, as the summer tourism season gets into high gear, we're going to talk about the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex and what's going on there. That's all for now. Space Talk, a production of Mila Solutions, brought to you thanks to the help of supporting sponsors Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. Please join us next Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern for another live hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now as WMMB presents a weekend edition of the Best of Bill Mick Live. I'm Jim Bankey, and we'll talk to you again real soon.